Ever wonder how much power Congress really has over the courts?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Well, buckle up, because today we're diving deep into United States v. Klein.
Klein.
Yeah, an 1871 Supreme Court showdown.
Wow, 1871, that's going way back.
It is, but it's still making waves in courtrooms today.
Really? I'm intrigued. What's so fascinating about this Klein case?
Well, for me, it's how it reveals those fault lines in the separation of powers.
Yeah, I can see that. So are we just talking about a historical curiosity then, or is there more to it?
Oh, there's definitely more to it. This case has been cited in modern disputes over everything from, Native American land claims to the rights of Guantanamo Bay to detainees.
Wow, that's a pretty wide range. Okay, so before we get to the modern stuff, let's set the stage.
Right. Back to the basics. We're talking post-Civil War America here.
1871, right after the Civil War. Got it.
And Congress is trying to figure out what to do with former Confederates.
And their property.
Exactly.
That's a tricky situation.
And you've got Lincoln's 1863 pardon offer in the mix, too.
Right, which allowed Confederates to regain property rights.
If they swore allegiance to the Union.
Okay, so an attempt at reconciliation, but as with most things in the Reconstruction era, it gets messy fast.
Messy how? Give me the juicy details.
Okay, so let's take the case of V.F. Wilson.
Okay.
He takes the oath, gets his pardon, and then dies.
Seems straightforward enough.
Right. But then his estate administrator, John Klein, tries to recover proceeds from the sale of Wilson's confiscated cotton.
Ah, so that's where the property dispute comes in.
Exactly. And that's when Congress throws a wrench in the works.
Congress is never one to miss an opportunity to complicate things, are they?
No, they are not.
So what do they do?
Okay, so in 1870, they passed this law.
Okay.
And it basically says pardons can't be used as proof of loyalty in property claims.
Oh, wow. Talk about a curveball.
Yeah. And to really drive the point home, they order courts to dismiss cases just like Klein's.
So they're basically changing the rules mid-game.
Exactly.
So we've got this constitutional clash brewing, right? On one side, you have Lincoln's pardon meant to smooth the waters.
Right.
On the other, Congress seems to be trying to steer the courts towards a specific outcome.
Yeah.
So what were the big constitutional questions at play here?
Well, the poor had to grapple with some huge E questions about the balance of power.
Okay, like what?
Well, first, was Congress overstepping its bounds by telling the courts how to decide a pending case?
Yeah, that's a big one.
Could Congress undermine the president's pardon power? And could Congress use its power over the Supreme Court's jurisdiction to achieve what looked like, some pretty shady goals?
So basically, they had to figure out who had the final say.
Yeah.
This is where Chief Justice Chase steps in, right?
Yeah, he was Chief Justice at the time.
And he was known for being pretty outspoken.
Oh, yeah, he definitely didn't hold back.
So what did he have to say about all of this?
Okay, so he delivered a scathing opinion for the majority. He basically slams Congress for trying to dictate outcomes in specific cases.
Wow, so he's not mincing words here.
No, he's not. And to him, the 1870 law was a blatant attack on judicial independence. It was like Congress was saying, "Hey, courts, just rubber stamp what we want, okay?"
Not exactly a recipe for an independent judiciary.
Nope.
But what about the president's pardon power? Did the court address that
Oh,
too?
absolutely.
Chase fiercely defends the president's pardon power, arguing that it's unlimited and can't be messed with by Congress.
Unlimited. Huh. That sounds like it could be problematic.
It does, doesn't it?
What are the implications of a pardon power with absolutely no restrictions?
Well, that's a debate that continues to this day.
I bet.
But the court in Klein was clear that Congress can't just come in after the fact and try to reinterpret or invalidate a pardon.
Okay. So they're putting their foot down.
Yeah.
But it raises some interesting questions, though, right?
Oh, definitely.
What are the limits on presidential power?
Right.
What safeguards are in place to prevent abuse?
Good questions.
So it sounds like the court sided pretty strongly with the president and Klein.
Yes, but there's an interesting wrinkle.
Oh.
Even one of the dissenting justices agreed that Congress overstepped its bounds, but he had a different take on the property rights issue.
Kofi, who was that?
Justice Miller.
All right, what did he say?
He argued that since the cotton was sold before the pardon, there are no property rights left to restore. It's like he's saying you can't revive something that's already gone, even with a pardon.
So even within the court itself, there was some disagreement about how to apply the law in this particular case.
Yeah, and that's what makes these cases so fascinating. It's not always black and white.
Right.
There are often multiple layers of legal arguments and different interpretations of how the Constitution should be applied to, you know, real world situations.
Yeah, it's not just a theoretical exercise.
No, it's not. But ultimately, the core holding in Klein that Congress can't dictate outcomes in pending cases stands as a major check on legislative power.
Okay, so we've got this historic decision, a clash of the titans, and some big questions about presidential power hanging in the air. But you said this case is still relevant today, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How is a case about confiscated cotton still shaping legal battles in the 21st century?
That's what we're going to unpack next. Klein has become this powerful legal tool that's been used to challenge everything from attempts to limit Native American land claims to the detention of individuals at Guantanamo Bay. It's a fascinating story of how this seemingly obscure case from the Reconstruction era continues to resonate today.
Well, I'm hooked.
Good.
Let's dive into the modern impact of Klein and how it's become a key player in some really important legal battles.
Let's do it. So we were talking about how the court basically called out Congress, right?
Yeah, for trying to pull a fast one. It was like watching a constitutional chess match. But the big question for me is, did Klein just fade into the background after 1871?
Oh, no. Klein is far from forgotten.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's become like a cornerstone of separation of powers law.
Huh.
And it's frequently cited in cases where there's a question of Congress overstepping its bounds.
So it's not just about Civil War era property disputes anymore.
Nope, not at all.
So give me some examples. How is this 150-year-old case still relevant in the 21st century?
Okay, well, one area where Klein has had a major impact is in cases involving Native American land claims.
Okay.
Back in the 1980s, Congress tried to retroactively extinguish certain Native American land claims.
Wait, so they were trying to rewrite history to their advantage?
Exactly.
Wow.
But the courts, citing Klein, stepped in and said, nope, you can't do that.
Good for them.
They recognized that Congress was trying to manipulate the legal system to achieve a specific outcome, and that violated the principles of separation of powers and judicial independence that Klein so clearly established.
So Klein is like this legal guardian,
yeah,
protecting the courts from political interference.
That's a great way to put it. Klein reinforces the idea that courts aren't just rubber stamps for the legislature.
Right, they have to be impartial.
Exactly. They have an independent duty to interpret the law fairly and impartially.
Okay, so we've got Native American land claims. Any other examples of how Klein's being used today?
Klein has also come up in cases involving the rights of detainees at Guantanamo Bay.
Guantanamo, okay.
Yeah, these cases often involve thorny questions about habeas corpus.
Right, habeas corpus, the right to challenge one's detention.
Exactly.
It's basically a legal safeguard that ensures that someone can't be held indefinitely without a fair hearing.
Exactly. It's a cornerstone of due process, and it's been a flashpoint in cases involving Guantanamo detainees.
So how does Klein, a case about property rights from the 1800s, tie in to these modern day habeas corpus cases?
Because the principle at stake in Klein that Congress can't use its power to undermine the independence of the judiciary is just as relevant when it comes to protecting individual liberties like habeas corpus.
Mm, I see.
One of the most notable examples of this connection is the case of Boumediene v. Bush in 2008.
Boumediene v. Bush. Okay, tell me more about that case. What are the facts there?
So this case involved detainees held at Guantanamo Bay who were challenging their detention without trial. The Bush administration argued that these detainees, classified as enemy combatants, didn't have the same habeas corpus rights as U.S. citizens.
So you've got these individuals held in this legal limbo, potentially stripped of their basic rights. What role did Congress play in all of this?
Well, Congress had actually passed legislation.
Okay.
The Military Commissions Act of 2006, which attempted to strip federal courts of jurisdiction to hear habeas corpus petitions from Guantanamo detainees.
Hold on. Isn't that exactly what the court shut down in Klein?
Yes.
Congress trying to manipulate jurisdiction to get the outcome they want.
You got it. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, struck down parts of the Military Commissions Act, citing Klein as a key precedent.
Wow.
They argued that Congress can't use this jurisdiction-stripping power to undermine the fundamental right of habeas corpus or to shield the executive branch from judicial review.
So Klein, this 150-year-old case about a pardon and some cotton, is helping to protect the rights of Guantanamo detainees in the 21st century.
It really is. It shows how the court can use precedent to safeguard individual rights and make sure all branches of government are playing by the rules.
It's kind of amazing when you think about it.
It is. Klein is a powerful reminder that the Constitution isn't just a dusty old document, it's a living framework that's constantly being interpreted and applied to new situations.
I'm starting to see why law students spend so much time poring over these historical cases. They're not just about the past, they're about setting precedents that shape how we understand the law today.
Absolutely. And Klein is a prime example. It shows us how seemingly small cases can have huge ripple effects throughout history, impacting everything from property rights to the very definition of liberty.
This is making me think about all the current political battles happening. With so much polarization these days, it seems like there's always a risk of one branch of government overstepping its bounds.
You're right, and that's why understanding cases like Klein is so important. It reminds us that the separation of powers and the court's role in upholding it is crucial for safeguarding our democracy and preventing tyranny.
So Congress can never limit the court's jurisdiction.
Well, that's where things get even more nuanced.
Okay.
While Klein sets a high bar for Congress to clear when it comes to jurisdiction stripping, there have been instances where the court has allowed Congress to limit its appellate jurisdiction. But it's only under very specific circumstances.
So what's the difference between a legitimate limitation and an unconstitutional power grab?
The key is that Congress can't use jurisdiction stripping as a way to dictate the outcome of a case or target specific litigants.
Okay.
They might be able to limit the court's jurisdiction over certain types of cases, like minor claims or state law issues. But if they're trying to achieve an unconstitutional end or to interfere with the court's core functions, that's when the ghost of Klein comes back to haunt them.
It sounds like there's always this tension between the branches of government each trying to exert its authority while staying within the boundaries of the Constitution.
That's the essence of our system of checks and balances. Each branch is designed to keep the others in check,
right?
Ensuring that no one branch becomes too powerful. And Klein serves as this constant reminder to Congress that they can't just sidestep the judiciary when it suits them.
This has been a real eye-opener. I never realized how much strategy and legal maneuvering goes into shaping our laws and protecting our rights.
It's like a constant game of constitutional tug of war. And United States v. Klein is one of those key moments where the Supreme Court held the line and reminded Congress that even they have to play by the rules.
So we've seen how Klein has been used to protect Native American land rights and the rights of Guantanamo detainees.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other areas of law where it's having a major impact?
Oh, absolutely. We're just getting started. Klein has also played a significant role in shaping the debate over executive power and the limits of presidential authority.
Okay, now we're talking. This is where things get really interesting. I'm ready to dive into how Klein is influencing the balance of power between the president and Congress.
Yeah.
So we've seen how United States v. Klein has been used to protect Native American land rights and the rights of Guantanamo detainees. And you were saying that it also plays a role in the debate over executive power.
Exactly. Klein is like this this hidden thread that connects all these different areas of law.
That's so interesting.
And what ties them together is this underlying concern about one branch of government, you know, overstepping its bounds and upsetting that delicate balance of power.
So how does a case about a Civil War pardon end up influencing how we think about presidential power today?
Well, remember how Chief Justice Chase fiercely defended that unlimited pardon power in Klein?
Oh, yeah.
That concept has come up again and again in cases that deal with, you know, the limits of presidential authority.
I see.
It's almost like Chase threw this constitutional grenade into the mix back in 1871, and the legal shrapnel is still flying.
Okay, I like that analogy. But seriously, what are the implications of this unlimited pardon power? Could a president just pardon their way out of anything?
That's a question that legal scholars and courts have been wrestling with ever since Klein, and there's no easy answer.
Yeah.
On the one hand, you have the argument that the pardon power is an essential tool for mercy and reconciliation.
Right.
It allows the president to correct injustices and offer a fresh start, even in cases where the legal system may have fallen short.
But what about the flip side?
Right.
What's to stop a president from abusing this power? Could they pardon themselves for crimes? Could they pardon their cronies to obstruct justice?
Those are the big what-ifs that Klein forces us to confront.
Right.
And they're not just theoretical concerns. These questions have come up in some very real and very high-stakes legal battles. Think about President Nixon and Watergate.
Hmm.
Or, more recently, the investigations into Russian interference in the 2016 election and potential obstruction of justice.
Those were some crazy times.
They were.
Those scandals had everyone talking about the limits of presidential power and whether the pardon power could be used as a shield against accountability. Did Klein come up in those discussions?
Absolutely. Klein is always lurking in the background when these questions of executive power and potential abuse arise. It's a reminder that even though the president has broad powers, those powers aren't limitless.
Right.
The courts have a role to play in making sure that no one, not even the president, is above the law.
So how do you see Klein continuing to influence the legal landscape in the future? Any predictions?
You know, I think Klein will continue to be a touchstone case as we grapple with these fundamental questions about the balance of power and the limits of presidential authority. As technology advances, as global politics shift, and as new challenges arise, we'll likely see Klein cited in cases that deal with everything from cybersecurity and data privacy to international relations, and even the potential use of artificial intelligence in warfare.
Wow. I never thought about it that way. It's amazing how a case from 1871 about a seemingly simple dispute over some cotton can still have such a profound impact on our legal system and our understanding of how power should be balanced in a democracy.
It really is. It's a testament to the enduring power of the Constitution and how it's designed to adapt to changing times. And cases like Klein show us how crucial it is for the courts to have the independence and the authority to interpret that Constitution and make sure that all branches of government are playing by the rules.
This has been an incredible deep dive. We've gone from Civil War pardons to Native American land claims to Guantanamo Bay detainees to presidential power grabs. Who knew one case could contain so much legal drama?
It's been quite a journey, hasn't it? And I hope our listeners walk away with a deeper understanding of how these seemingly obscure historical cases can still have a profound impact on our lives today.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on this exploration of United States v. Klein. It's a case that's sure to keep sparking debate and influencing legal arguments for generations to come.
And until next time, keep those legal minds engaged.